We are continuing our discussion of our final question in our series, question number 23, why do the righteous suffer? And we have made it down through the first two bullet points on the board. And so we're continuing our discussion with the third. Again, it's our practice to go through this material fairly rapidly, and then get into the questions where we'll flesh it out a bit more. But what we mentioned when the question is asked, why do the righteous suffer? What we mentioned last week is that's a bit of an exaggeration in regard to generalizing. The idea is the righteous suffer, the wicked prosper, and why is that? That's really not what happens. There are righteous people that prosper, and there are wicked people that suffer. And in reality, the fact is that suffering is the lot of all men. It's allotted for all men to, at some point in time, in some part of their life, to suffer. That's one of the things that becomes obvious as you look at the book of Ecclesiastes. As the writer writes about all of the happiness and joy and accomplishments that might be found in life, that if a man lives long upon the earth, there are many days that are evil. Everyone suffers as a result of their time on the earth. The question still needs to be asked, however. Why is it that God allows His people, those who are seeking to live righteously, to suffer? Because there are individuals out there who make some really outlandish promises concerning the benefits of faith. And I say outlandish in the sense of being untrue. But in actuality, what they are doing is cheapening the concept of reward when it comes to the subject of faith, which is something we'll talk about in just a few moments. But they do claim that as a result of giving your faith to God, giving yourself to God, that God is going to bless you, your life is going to get better, you're going to prosper materially, all your problems are going to melt away, all of those things are going to be accomplished as a result of faith. And all you have to do is to look in the New Testament and you find, or in the Bible, because Job would be a good example. Look in the Bible and you find example after example after example of good people suffering despite their faith. In fact, although it's not something that is included in the material that we're covering, I would like you very quickly to go over to Hebrews chapter 11. And I want you to notice the quick list, if you will, of those who suffered or those who expressed their faith in verses 30 and following. He spends some time talking about these stories of which we are familiar, these historical accounts of which we're familiar with regard to the major Old Testament characters. But you'll also notice in verse 32 of the text, he says, "What more shall I say? The time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets." Now notice what these individuals accomplished, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. So there are positive effects with regard to these. Women received their dead raised to life again. But then, he says, others, these are the same list of faithful that he's referring to here, others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. So this is talking about the same group of righteous, faithful people here in this particular text. But some look at what is accomplished as a result of their faith. Look at it as the favor that is bestowed upon them by God as a result of their faith. But then you have this other list, And it's not one of these things where it's either this or that, in the sense of whether you're faithful or not. These were both groups of faithful individuals that are being referred to here, and yet the end result is very different. I'm reminded, as we talked in our sermon last week with regard to Daniel and his three friends that are commonly known by the Babylonian names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But those three, you'll remember their statement when they were charged with bowing down before Nebuchadnezzar. They wouldn't do it. And as such, they were to be thrown into the fire. And their answer was, in effect, we have faith that God's going to spare us, but if he doesn't, we're still not going to worship him. And so they were willing to die as a result of their faith. And had no true assurance that they would be spared the death by flame. So, no, there is no promise that we have of any great rewards or a more favorable physical life and existence as a result of our faith. Now, there are a couple of things I want to make note of that. Note with regard to that. One is, what does happen when you live physically, when you live a Christian life. But then secondly, to acknowledge that we still have that question we have to answer. If the righteous do suffer, why is it that they suffer? Even if we dissuade individuals from believing that that there is a distinction between the wicked and the righteous, the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, or some inequity in that regard. Even if we are able to prove that the lot of all men is the same with regard to some suffering and some joy. It's just the lot of all men. The question remains as to why God allows it to be that way or why God has determined it to be that way. So we'll answer that question. That's going to take up the primary aspect of this. But I do want to, as we talk about this, know that there are benefits physically to living a life of Christian. While it may be true that an individual will suffer persecution as a result of that faith, it is also true that when you have a government, for example, that is as our government is, and I recognize there are changes that are coming, but for generations in the United States, faith was tolerated, and so an individual who lives a life of faithfulness, he's a law-abiding citizen, he's going to have it better with regard to his relations with civil government. And in fact, that's also the same thing even when you have intolerant governments to one extent or another, because the Apostle Paul made an allusion to that with regard to the Roman government in Romans chapter 13 when he called upon all to obey the governing authorities. And that if you obey, that you do not have to be afraid of them. They are a terror to evildoers, not those who are law-abiding citizens. So there's a benefit to living a Christian life, because a Christian is going to obey the law of the land, so long as they do not violate the laws of God. Secondly, a life that is lived as a Christian is a life of moderation, which would preclude often destructive behavior, such as drunkenness, gluttony, and other types of addictive actions or dangerous lifestyles. And so it is something that can keep an individual safe and healthy to live as a Christian. Thirdly, when one lives as a Christian because he is doing what he does to God rather than man, he becomes a good employee. He becomes a good father. He becomes a good mother, or she does. Or a good citizen, or a good friend, a good next-door neighbor. And as a result of that, the relations that he sustains with other individuals are, for the most part, relationships that are pleasant or at least tolerable. You know, we have some next-door neighbors that Debbie has especially been helpful to, a young couple that they don't have a car and they run into some problems from time to time. She helps them out, and I do as well, but help them out as often as possible. They're not Christians. We've been trying to get them interested in studying without much luck as up to this point in time. We're going to continue to try. But regardless, they like us, and we like them all right as well. And so there's this relationship that sustains simply because of the way we're conducting ourselves and the way they're conducting themselves. So there are positive benefits to these kinds of things. But that doesn't change the fact that there's a possibility that a drunk driver may take the life of a Christian, or that a terrible disease may afflict a Christian, or a typhoon may hit and destroy the home of a Christian, or that some other evil might befall a Christian, that a Christian will suffer. Death is the lot of all men. We all have lost those that we love, and we know of many who have gone on to their reward, who were faithful Christians, but we know that the family suffers when they die. And so these are very valid questions. This perhaps is the most troubling question, I suppose, of all that we've done in the 23 to Christians. We struggle with this as well, as why these things are so. And I think there are some good things that we can look at in the material that will be beneficial to us. First thing that I do want to acknowledge is there in the third bullet point, that is this question of why the righteous suffer, in a sense, is not relevant. Because what it is focusing our interest and concern on the temporal aspects of life, rather than, as we've talked about before, getting our focus upon above the horizon for those things that are eternal. And when we talk specifically about God's part, the part that God plays in these things, I'm not going to worship a God, or I don't have any interest in a God who allows people who love Him to suffer in this way, or people in general to suffer, or anyone to suffer. They have a very short-sighted approach to this particular question. And what we find in this second letter that Paul wrote to the Thessalonians is what I consider, as a Christian, to be a wonderful word of assurance. It is certainly not that for the unrighteous, but for the Christian, it is something that gives us a great deal of comfort. And by the way, he was talking to a group of people to whom this question had some significance. The Thessalonians at this particular point in time were suffering persecution. There is that acknowledgement of that persecution in verse 4. We ourselves boast of you among the churches of God for your patience and faith in all your persecutions and tribulations that you endure. So here were individuals that the Apostle Paul acknowledged as being faithful Christians who nevertheless were suffering both persecution and tribulation, which he says in verse 5 is manifest evidence of the righteous judgment of God, that you may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God for which you also suffer. Now, in this, there is the initial change of focus. We're talking about the kingdom of God, and these individuals have been found worthy to suffer for the sake of the kingdom. This is an indication of God's righteous judgment. This is an indication as they, even in the midst of their persecution and their tribulation, that they are worthy of something that is to come. But it is to come. It's not yet here. And so the fact that they're suffering because of their faith is an evidence of God's righteousness. Now, when he talks about his righteousness, he talks about his righteousness within the context of judgment. And when he talks about the judgment, he, of course, is referring to the final judgment, where all the accounts are settled. Not settled on this earth. It's not about what you suffer on this earth. It's not about whether the wicked get away with things that are evil and prosper regardless of their unethical actions on this earth. He talks about individuals. Notice he says, it is a righteous thing, verse 6, a righteous thing with God to repay those who trouble you. So this is God's righteous judgment. It will happen in the judgment day. And what he's going to do, he's going to repay those who trouble you and give you who are troubled rest. So what is the repayment for those who trouble you? Tribulation. He goes on and defines that type of tribulation when he says, when he comes with his mighty angels, he will come, verse 8, in flaming fire, taking vengeance. It's on those who trouble you. Now, he restates it now. He uses different language, but it's the same group. Those who trouble, those who are persecuting them, are those who do not know God, those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. These shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power when He comes in that day. Now, when He comes in that day, it is to give you who are troubled rest, having reference to those who are righteous. He will be glorified in His saints, and be admired among all who believe, because our testimony among you was believed. And so the day of judgment is where we need to focus if we want to talk about suffering and prosperity. And if we're going to be talking about whether or not God is a just God, then we have to understand the accounts and the question of his justice and his goodness is not settled on this earth. It is settled in judgment. And it will be manifest. When we talk about the manifest justice of God, manifest means evident. In other words, when that time comes, everyone is going to acknowledge that God is just. You have so many people today that say God is not just. God cannot be just, because if God were just, then thus and such would not happen to such and such a person. God's not just. And I'm telling you that when that day comes, that day of judgment comes, every individual, those who are condemned as well as those who find rest, will acknowledge the justice of God. They'll be aware of it. It will be manifest to them. There will be no denying that God is a righteous God, that God is a just God. It's just that people don't want to think about that day. They want to think about today. Think about what's going on now. And when they're suffering, they want to blame God for their suffering. When they're hurting, when there's tribulation, when they're not having an easy time with their life. Why, God, are you allowing this to happen to them? It's not about now. It's about eternity. It's about that judgment day, where you'll be then. And so that's where God's justice is something that's obvious. Now, that doesn't, again, completely answer the question, why is it happening now, with regard to those things. But I do want you to acknowledge and to recognize that it's not entirely relevant, because those of us who are concerned about, preoccupied is the term I was thinking of, we're preoccupied with what's going on for the 4 score years we're on this earth, we're missing the whole point of all this, our very existence on this earth. And if we can acknowledge the fact that ultimately, no matter how much you must suffer, no matter how difficult your life is, if you live for Christ, it's going to be worth it, then we begin to see God's justice. And so looking at that, we acknowledge that from 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. And then we won't spend time looking at these verses, but I do want you to understand that, as we've already alluded to, we do acknowledge, recognize that the good suffer alongside the evil. In fact, in 1 Peter 3:13 through 17, the Apostle Peter refers to the possibility of suffering specifically because you are good, suffering as a Christian. So the very fact that you are a Christian, the very fact that you're serving God, may be a cause for you to suffer. In James chapter 1, as we read in the text Caleb read it earlier, that when an individual suffers in that regard, let me go there and read it very quickly again. He says, count it joy. That's the word that I was looking for. But count it all joy when you fall into various trials. So in action, there's a positive aspect to this. But it is that recognition that because they are brethren, because they're Christians, that they will fall into various trials. Now, that trial allows you to be matured and become perfect, lacking nothing. So it has a benefit to it, which is something people don't always get and often are unable to acknowledge. And by the way, it's an interesting thing, because how many times have you acknowledged that you have become a better person as a result of the suffering that you've experienced in your life? I think all of us can recognize how we have learned lessons. PA, just to put you on the spot a little bit, because you're old enough to remember this, the very, very difficult economic times in the Great Depression and the time following that. Better person because of what you've learned in that.
Super worse.
And I knew you were going to say that, because we talked about it before. Now, that's not necessarily something he would ever want to happen again, or that some of us who are younger would have to suffer through such economic deprivation. But it built character. Men who have gone off to war, they've come back and they're changed, and they're stronger, and they're more courageous, and there's maturity that wasn't there before. Now, by the way, such trial and tribulation can break a person too. But an individual who overcomes that is strengthened as a result of it. So we acknowledge that. So if this is a tool which enables us to become mature, it strengthens us, it makes us stronger, then why is it that we're going to blame God for it? As a parent, there are certain things that I allow my children to suffer because I knew that it would be good for them. I'm not talking about corporal punishment. I'm not talking about spanking. I think that added benefit as well. But inequities, unfairness, when they came home and they started complaining about how the teacher wasn't fair to them, instead of getting up there and getting in the teacher's face and talking about how you're mistreating my child, tell your child, tough it out. Learn to live with it. Learn from it. Be stronger as a result of it. And they have benefited as a result of those kinds of things. So, there is benefit in the trial and tribulation. There can be. Not that I'm saying that God directly causes it, but He can allow those things. We'll talk about that a little bit as well. But again, an individual who says God is not a just God, or He could not be a just God if He allows such suffering to happen, allows it because He's omnipotent. He can do anything. He allows it. He's an evil God. Understand that that there is benefit to suffering, and good things can come from it. Yes, please.
Are we trying to approach this lesson from the idea of us talking about why we suffer, or from the idea of someone coming to us and saying, "I can't be a Christian because there's suffering"?
I took this particular question as an individual that you would, because it's happened to me so many times, an individual that you'll come across who maybe looks to you as a spiritually minded person who is in the midst of suffering, and asks, "Why does God allow this to happen to me?" Okay? And again, what I'm trying to give is an intellectual basis for these kinds of things, a scriptural basis for those kinds of things, which is helpful to know and to recognize to enable you to help an individual. To give you an example, a lot of times people will say when a small child is taken and their life is taken through accident or whatever the case may be, you'll hear it's often done in various religious teachers and all say that God took him, God wanted him, God wanted to take him to be with Him. Those kinds of words are used, which can be very, very frustrating to people who love their child. And do not like the fact that no matter how good God is, no matter how much better their child is, that the child was taken from them. Why did you do that to me? Well, that's not a theologically accurate response in the first place, and I don't think it's particularly beneficial. But if we recognize the reason why suffering happens and the part that God plays in it, which is what we're going to, questions flesh out, then it'll be helpful.
Because there really is two very different ways of looking at it. So if you go to James and you say, "All right, James says that count all joy when you fall into various trials because it builds up this endurance." Well, what good is the endurance if there were no trials to begin with? Are you going to need courage in heaven? Are you going to need endurance in heaven? Why aren't we just already in heaven? And that's one direction that people will approach it from. So sometimes when people come asking about the suffering, you have to approach it from that angle.
Sure.
On the other side, you can approach it more from the angle of, okay, there are things to endure, so it's good to have trials to build endurance. But what good is the endurance? Well, so you don't fall again. All right, so what's the networking benefit of that? What's the kingdom benefit of that? I see the benefit to me. What's the kingdom benefit of that? The kingdom benefit is when you go over to Acts 5 and they said they counted it all joy that they got to suffer for Christ's sake. Well, why? Not because they just got to suffer. Because light shines more brightly in darkness. And I think that's one of the biggest things, is that the suffering allows us to have an opportunity for influence that if everything was just great, we wouldn't have.
Very good. Very good point, yeah. Yeah, it's an amazing thing when you see the different way that Christians respond to tribulation and hardship and persecution, those kinds of things, than often is the typical response you see in the world. I'll just give you as an example. the media and the way that what you'll find often whenever there's some tragedy or something, how people will turn on each other. And you've got, you know, anytime you have a microphone, they're sticking a microphone in front of somebody's face and they're gossiping about this other person or turning on them and those kinds of things. And I've seen a couple of occasions where one that comes to mind specifically was when the wife shot Wendell Winkler's grandson. And she had shot him, and of course it turned out there was some sort of things about all of that. She shot him in the back with a shotgun. And when they went to the congregation of Christians and asked them about this woman, what kind of woman she was, trying to dig up dirt, not a single one of them would speak evil of her. They all were very kind about her and concerned about her, as well as the family and the, you know, the lost preacher and all that kind of things. It was an interesting thing. I just happened to turn over to one of these channels where the lady, she was just trying to get dirt. That's what she was trying to do. She kept asking and trying to ask leading questions. You know, did you see anything? Or, well, isn't it true that she was? And those kinds of things. And they simply wouldn't let that happen. And it was really quite amazing. And stood in stark contrast to what we typically see during those kinds of circumstances, those situations. And it made me proud of the fact that these are individuals that were applying the scriptural principles as men and women of faith, that under great duress, to where it was frustrating the reporter, but it was obvious that these people are different than what you typically see, and they're acting different than what you normally see people act. And it's because of faith. And so that's a wonderful point to be made. Whenever tribulation comes and you're able to handle it, you conduct yourself as a Christian, the world sees that. It's a wonderful witness. Your brethren see it, and it's something that strengthens them. So that the strengthening that comes from within, the edification that comes when you see it. And we talk often about how much we are encouraged by the way some people react with the loss of Adam Smeltzer, the reaction of his family and his father, some of the things that he wrote on and that were circulated right after he found out about the death of his son. Just absolutely amazing expressions of the faith of a person who gets it, who understands it. And that's very much an encouragement. And so that's a wonderful point to make. Anybody? Yes, Scott.
I was thinking that a spotlight, and I see the question mark above your head. But I was reading the Simon Box, and it says 5 million candle power. And think about the concept of candle power and how small it is, and it is able to be seen as what we are, by our examples.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. And I've emphasized that a lot of times when I preach on the subject, the city set on the hill, you know, we don't put our light under a bushel. But the fact that light always defeats darkness, it doesn't matter. You can get as dark as it possibly can be, you know, and you can paint the walls black, and you can cover the windows, and you can make it inky blacky, but, you know, everything, and then you light a little candle, and the candle can be seen, the light can be seen, and not only that, it illuminates its surrounding to one extent or another. And conversely, if you have that one little candle lit, you can try to get everything else as black as you possibly can, but you can't extinguish the light. The light will be seen. Light is victorious over dark. A dark is an absence of light. So when light enters in, then it is a great influence. It illuminates, and when we can enter into the world, then our influence cannot be hidden. It will be effective. And this is just one way we can serve as a good Christian influence. Yes, Dave.
I was with the subject of why did the righteous suffer, as Justin brought up. It was a question asked, the person asked you, or does it apply to, you know, but both would be valid, you know, like that. And it's like, as you alluded to there about how the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. And we know from the scriptures that the good things happen to the unjust and the just. And bad things happen to the just and the unjust. And for some think that, why me, Lord, you know. But when we go to Philippians 4:19 and paraphrasing it, that through the faithful God provide our every need for both body, soul, and spirit. So those things do happen.
Written by a man who was in prison at the time.
Right. And of course there's good things and bad things, and some God involved, some allows, and then Satan brings about, and something just happened, you know. Step off of a six-story building where the gravity's going to take over, give you a violator that. Or if you mentioned about the drunk driver, I mean, he's coming on the wrong way on the freeway, and you're in the right place at the right time, there's going to be a collision, you're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
Or worse, so it's that.
Yeah, by the way, we're spending a lot of time talking about the fact that it does happen, and we haven't gotten yet to the point of explaining why it happens, which is the point I wanted to make,
I know it was really good, but Sunday morning said about having said, but we kind of discussed it in the Tuesday night men thing about that, and about these three different ways. Remember how you said that you made a comment, you know, on the no matter what happened, good, back, or indifference. Remember?
You're not talking about last night. Previous week. Okay.
Yeah, we just had. I mean, that just happened.
I think if I'm thinking what you're saying,
I thought it was real good. You know.
Yeah, the idea is whether the. When something bad happens to you, one of three possibilities. One is that God is allowing it as a test, which we'll talk about a little bit in this that God allowed it with regard to Job. There were tribulations that came upon Israel because of punishment or chastisement. So it can there can be certain circumstances to where trouble befalls you because God determines that that's something that is needed for you. The second possibility is that evil can come as a result of Satan's efforts. In other words, there is an active, malevolent agent that is striving to destroy you. And as a result of that, whether it be temptation or evil that befalls men, Satan is the origin of those kinds of things. So Satan can have a hand in it. The third possibility is that, as Nick kind of alluded to, happenstance, that sometimes things happen. Individual just makes a bad choice with physical consequences, or sometimes the disease just happens because of a mutated cell in your body, or whatever the case may be. It may not be that there's anything malevolent about that. If I remember right, it was it not the blind man when the questions were asked, who sinned, him or his parents? And Jesus' answer was neither. Not all things that are constant suffering come directly from God or directly from the devil. We're just living in a fallen world, and as a result of that, sometimes bad things happen. So, regardless of where it comes from, the response of the Christian is the same. That's what, if that's what you're alluding to, Dick was making note of. The response is the same. And that is, you respond righteously, and you use such an opportunity to grow stronger and more mature as a Christian. And if the response is the appropriate response, that which God calls Christians to do as they suffer this persecution or tribulation, then regardless of where it comes from, whether it's a chastisement from God, a temptation of the devil, or simply a matter of happenstance, the same effect is the result, and that is a stronger Christian as a result of it. We don't have to know exactly why what is happening to us, why it's happening. I got a Facebook post from Jeremy Carroll, Justin's brother, just today, and he was asking me with regard to 1 Peter 5:1-4, why Peter wrote that to the elders, because it seemed like what he was writing was something that they already knew. Well, I suppose that this is why he did it, but in reality, we don't need to know, have to know why the Holy Spirit did what He did, so long as we do what the Holy Spirit tells us to do. So there are sometimes, you know, some people ask, "Well, you know, why do you have to be baptized? Why does God say we have to be baptized?" You know, I've got my supposes, some things that I think that are obvious in that regard. But ultimately, I don't need to know why, as long as I know He did and I respond to that. And so sometimes the why is not always there. But in regard to suffering or difficulties in my life, regardless of whether I know why it's happening to me, if I respond the way God would have me to respond, I'm going to be better off ultimately as a result of it. Anyway.
Sometimes the power of God is showing through the bad things that happen.
Sure.
And if we respond poorly, we can keep that from happening. Like, for instance, not that God's power is ever inhibited by us. I don't mean that. What I'm saying is we can lessen the effectiveness on an unbeliever. You know, like in this case, you know, with her situation, why did she have to go through it? Trial of not knowing what was going to happen with her brain tumor, and yet it all turned out well. Well, maybe it was so God could be glorified in her, and her, and through her faith that she's had influence on a number of unbelievers who've been involved in her case through this trauma.
And the point there is, and you know, we have this tendency to want to know the whys. And you've heard the phrase, whittling at God's end of the stick. There's a little bit of that to it. In other words, we wonder about that. But God is so much, he transcends us. And his ways are so much beyond ours that ultimately we cannot have those full understandings inside of eternity. So to, you know, to use your example in the case with regard to Hope and her medical condition, perhaps God was using that. Well, regardless of whether you have that purpose or can know that purpose, the fact is that God was glorified. See, we don't have to worry so much about suppose or maybe was or why. Well, maybe it was, and those kinds of questions are not necessarily answered, but the actual result of our response to tribulation is that God is glorified. We are strengthened. Things are proven, and we are proven as a result of those kinds of things. And that happened, and we can know it happened because we can see the results. And that's our end of the stick. We're not our end as we acknowledge those results and everything. And sometimes the speculation is something that where there's no way that we can truly understand to be for sure.
Another example of that was with Joseph and all that he suffered.
You
know, he didn't know why these things were happening to him. But he didn't know why all that was happening. But later, when he spoke to his brothers, he said, "You meant for evil, but God meant for good."
Yeah.
And we have to, when bad things happen to us, we have to keep that focus. That someone else maybe is having evil upon us. And if they do, shame on them. But how we respond could make a huge impact on us. Who knows? In Joseph's case, it was the rest of that world.
And you think about that, it's a real good object lesson for a second reason, and that is from the time that Joseph was sold into slavery as a young man until the time he was able to save his family from famine, a lot of years had passed. And that was a lot of years of, like you said, heartache and personal trial, but then prosperity and all these things happened. So these events in his life were intertwined as a result of him being sold into slavery. His family was saved from starvation. And how much time passed? I don't know. 30 years? 40 years? I don't know how. We probably could figure it out if we were to go back and look at chronology. It's been a while. But let's say 30 years had passed. And so there was 30 years before maybe Joseph had an understanding as to why these things had happened. We're wanting to know why these things have happened. And if it doesn't happen in the next 15 minutes, we're frustrated. And if it hasn't happened next week, then we're completely frustrated about those things. And if it hadn't happened in a month, then we're absolutely convinced it's never going to happen. We're never going to know. Well, maybe we will. You know, but the fact is that God's ways are not ours, and God's mind is not ours. And again, we need to kind of get away from the speculation of the part and just put our emphasis upon the actual result. Just very quickly, so that we can kind of get through this this material and then get into questions next week. I do want to note that 2 Timothy 3, which is the fourth bullet, the third verse, actually. actually says that as a result of our living in godly in Christ, we will suffer persecution. So that's kind of a promise that we will suffer because of our faith. Then the next point, it shows a discontentment with the promise of eternity. We've emphasized that already. But you have those who have set their minds on the flesh. We have to understand that the Spirit is life. And that if we acknowledge that it is eternity that's what's under consideration, then these inequities that we see as we consider our lives are in reality not inequities at all. Because the account is settled in eternity. And then the final point, and we're going to talk about this and enlarge upon it as we get into the questions. But understand this. When we see misery on this earth, remember that when God created the earth and put man in it, such misery did not exist. And if man had done as man was told to do, then the misery that exists in this earth would have been absent from this earth. God is not the one who is the cause of these things. And God is not the one that we should blame when those things happen. So we're going to have to talk a little bit about God's sovereignty, why He allows it. But understand this, even if God allows evil things to happen, God is not the one who is responsible for the evil that befalls man. He's not responsible. And there's a real reason why. It has to do with man's free will that we want to talk about in more detail, perhaps next week. But keep that in mind. Of course, that's what's indicated from James in the text of chapter 1 and it says 16 and 17. But, well, okay, so the point is that God is the giver of every good and perfect gift. But previous to that, in verse 13, it said, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone." So it's not God. God is perfect. God gives good things. But man corrupts good things. And that's why evil happens. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we move on. Okay? So we've kind of set the table to answer the question next week. All right, we'll get into the questions in our discussion next week. Appreciate everyone's kind attention and good comments tonight.